Americans, Israeli authorities approved the construction of more than 3,400. Settler units in the occupied West Bank. The Taliban propose a three-month ceasefire with the Afghan government in return for the release of 7,000 militant prisoners. And the death toll from heavy rain and floods in Western Germany rises to 19, with dozens of people reported missing. Hello and welcome, everybody. Israel's new prime minister has relaunched a controversial project for the construction of over 3,400 settler units in the occupied West Bank. The so-called Iwan project involves the construction of an unbuilt area of the occupied land. It cuts land access between Palestinian inhabited territories in the West Bank, rendering any future unified Palestinian state unviable. Former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu also tried to advanced the project, but it was halted under pressure from the international community, the Palestinian Authority, and rights groups. The project is also expected to draw objections from Prime Minister Naftali Bennett's left-wing coalition partners, as well as the U.S. All Israeli settlements on occupied Palestinian land are illegal under international law. Mona Candiel has given us more details on the new Israeli settlement project in the occupied West Bank.
Those 3,412 new settler units would be built in the occupied West Bank, mainly in one of the biggest Israeli settlements known as Ma'ale Adumim. These settlements are part of the E1 project that would be linking some West Bank cities with East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, allowing settlers to move freely from the Ma'ale Adumim settlement and the settlements around it to inside Jerusalem Al-Quds, however, separating Palestinian villages and towns and cities. It would be separating the central of the occupied West Bank from northern the occupied West Bank. And this, of course, would be very difficult for the Palestinians. According to experts and anti-settlement groups, what we have read this morning, that this might lead to a new conflict or a possible conflict between the American administration and the Israeli regime, because it seems that the U.S. administration is trying to convince the Israelis not to declare about major settlement projects that would be bringing some problems, whether to the Israeli regime and to the Israeli Prime Minister Bennett himself.
The Israeli military says it has arrested some 30 Palestinian students after they visited the house of a Hamas prisoner, which the regime demolished last week. The military has accused the students of being terror operatives, and it claims they transferred money for the Hamas resistance movement and organized its activities in Judea and Samaria. The students are from Beer Zeit University in the occupied West Bank. The university has condemned their detention, calling it, quote, a violation of all international laws and norms that guarantee students' right to freedom of movement. It also called on the international community to intervene immediately to secure their release. Hamas has described the Israeli move as a miserable attempt to harm the spirit of resistance among Palestinians and their support for the families of prisoners, martyrs, and wounded. A UK-based NGO reveals Britain's arms delivery to Saudi Arabia has been three times more than it was previously announced. During our news review program, we discussed the issue with our guests. Let's take a listen. this edition of the program, Britain has reportedly exported around 3 times the amount of weaponry and military equipment to Saudi Arabia than it previously announced. A recent investigation by Campaign Against Arms Trade shows British officials have used a loophole in the country's so-called transparent export controls. The report says the move intends to hide the real extent of the UK's contribution to the Saudi aggression against Yemen. While authorities claim British ministers signed off £6.7 billion worth of arms sales, the probe says the true figure is likely to be closer to £20 billion. Meanwhile, the UK's Department for International Trade, which approves all arms exports, has not disputed the findings of the study. Saudi Arabia launched a war on Yemen in March 2015. Tens of thousands of people, mostly civilians, have lost their lives since then. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent Said Purozo is joining us from the British capital, London. Also, we have historian and journalist Brett Yonkers, who's joining us from Hasselt. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Said, let's start off with you. It's great to see you. Let's talk about the contribution that Britain is making to the aggression against Yemen. Why has it increased threefold now? There are talks of a loophole in the investigation by the Campaign Against Arms Trade says that British officials have used a loophole in the so-called transparent export controls. What's really going on here?
Great to be with you, Bardia. We'll get to the why in a little bit, but let's have a look at that loophole and how they did it. As you said earlier, there are 2 ways that the British government is operating in this manner. The first way is they have a standard licenses system. They publish the arms that they are selling to whatever that country is, who they are selling it to. They're completely transparent as far as that is concerned, hence that £6.7 billion pounds worth of weapons. But what they're not telling people is the rest of the money and the rest of the arms that they've been selling to Saudi Arabia and probably other autocratic regimes. There is a parallel, opaque, or less transparent system called the open license system. And as the name suggests, really, there is no limit. There is no monetary limit. Arms manufacturers can sell however amount of weaponry to, in this case, Saudi Arabia and many other countries. Between, I think, 2011 and 2019, they sold billions of pounds worth of weapons to 53 countries. Two-thirds of those countries are known to have really not a great record as far as human rights.
Brett Yonkers in Hasselt. Mr. Yonkers, give us your thoughts on the investigation by the Campaign Against Arms Trade. 3 times more weapons will most likely lead to X times more deaths. Why is this happening?
Well, we have to always bear in mind that when we're talking about the war against Yemen, which is often called, and correctly, of course, in a way, called the Saudi-led coalition or the Saudi-led invasion of Yemen. But we have to bear in mind when we talk about this that it is not just Saudi Arabia that is at the helm. In fact, when you see on the ground, Saudi Arabia itself has very little control sometimes over these various militias and terrorist groups that they are harnessing there to fight against the National Salvation Government of Yemen. And Saudi-backed groups are often in conflict against Emirati-backed groups, which are in theory also, of course, part of the Saudi-led coalition. But what I would like to focus on, of course, is the wider perspective. It's not merely a Saudi-led coalition. Of course, the Saudis have taken it upon themselves to lead this coalition, this invasion on the ground. But in reality, this Saudi war is also a British war, is also an American war. It's, for an extent, also a French war, and is definitely an Israeli, a Zionist war. So all these countries, these major powers, have often banded together ever since 2015 to try to subdue this what they saw as a threat rising up in Yemen under the National Salvation Government after the revolution of September the 21st, 2014. Which, of course, they have covered up by calling it an Iranian-backed Shia rebel group, which it is not, which it isn't. It's an organization, Ansar Allah, or the Houthis, especially, are an organization and have been around for decades and have been showing themselves as a very indigenous and a very Yemeni revolutionary organization. But now, when you see this, these new revelations, as sad as it may be, it is definitely not surprising. We have seen over the past 6 years, nearly almost 7 years now, the constant coming to light of reports on Western powers, and especially recently European powers, that have been trying to circumvent their humanitarian duties and their adherence to international law, of course, by selling weapons to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, specifically with the knowledge that these weapons will be used against Yemen. I know for a fact that it has taken several years for my own country of Belgium to finally relent and decide to stop exports to Saudi Arabia. The same thing has happened, fortunately, as well in Germany, and especially in Italy, which has taken one of the strongest stances against the UAE and Saudi Arabia in all of Europe. But unfortunately, the major, real big players in terms of arms export to Saudi Arabia have not or barely done anything to stop this. And then I'm talking, of course, about the United States, the United Kingdom, France, and also Canada, which have kept on sending weapons, have kept on finding loopholes. In many ways, that's why these corporations, especially the ones that have like systems or technology or something in their name, in many ways, what they do is they sell technological systems that are not always necessarily a single appliance, let's say, which means that they can theoretically also be used for non-military means. And that way, these countries, these Western countries and these Western corporations, cover themselves up by saying the only thing we're doing is selling technology to Riyadh and to Abu Dhabi. Of course, they know full well that this technology, in many cases, this is things that can be used as targeting software or other equipment that can be used for the high-end, high-tech weaponry and weapon system that Saudi Arabia uses in its war against Yemen.
All right, let's leave it there. Historian and journalist Brett Yonker is joining us from Hasselt. Also, thanks to Said Pourreza speaking to us from the British capital, London. With it, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. The Taliban have proposed a three-month ceasefire in return for the release of about 7,000 of their members held in Afghan jails. The militant group has also wanted the names of its leaders to be removed from a UN blacklist. An Afghan government negotiator involved in peace talks with the Taliban has called it a big demand. The development comes as the militants have stepped up their attacks on cities and villages, taking a swath of territories under their control since May. They've also captured several border crossings, including with Pakistan, Iran, and Turkmenistan. The Afghan military has launched offensives to retake the areas captured by the militants. Dozens of Taliban militants have reportedly been killed in operations. Well, according to sources, local governments in Badghis province and the Taliban have agreed on a ceasefire. We'll keep you posted on the details of that story and much more as we get it for you right here on Press TV elsewhere. Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, which was home to the largest U.S. military base over the past 20 years, is now under the control of the Afghan government. U.S. withdrawal from the base came only after spending billions of dollars and leaving behind thousands of civilian deaths under the pretext of waging war on terror. Amin Alami has visited the base and filed this report.
Bagram Air Base in northern Parwan province was known as the main U.S. military headquarters in Afghanistan over the past 20 years. This is why experts have blamed the U.S. for wasting international aids to Afghanistan by building America's largest military base in the country.
The U.S. has built Bagram military base by wasting international aids that were earmarked for modernization of the Afghan National Army and the country's development. The air base is now vacated without U.S. achieving its goals.
As this army general says, the U.S. forces informed Afghans of their pullout earlier, but set no exact time for their departure.
Early morning, once we received some rumors that U.S. Army left the Bagram, we increased our intelligence and our reports. We got that, yes, they left the Bagram, and after that we entered to the base and took the all towers and secure. Mm-hmm. inside of the back room as well.
After talking to the ANA commander, we headed to former symbol of U.S. military power in Afghanistan, Bagram Air Base. A parking lot is located at one of the four entrances of the air base. The U.S. forces have left many of these vehicles behind. Afghan forces say U.S. forces have disabled the electronic systems of these military vehicles instead of disabling the war machine of Taliban.
Now, Afghan officials said they are going to fix such military vehicles to use them in fighting against terrorism across Afghanistan.
After crossing the entrance gate, we faced a real American town where U.S. forces have spent long nights and days despite failing to achieve their major stated goal that was uprooting terrorism here. Now, Afghans are in charge of such mission.
Having control over Bagram helps Afghan forces to effectively manage and launch counter-terrorism operations against terrorist groups.
It seems that the U.S. forces had access to high technology, emergency protection measures and welfare amenities in different parts of this airfield to reduce the level of harm, particularly the psychological harm that was coming from the Afghan war to U.S. forces. For instance, this gas station had been supplying fuel to hundreds of big generators across the air base. Afghan forces have collected these GEM tools from different GEMs located in Bagram, saying the U.S. forces had access to not only GEMs, but also to cinema and restaurants as well. Despite being equipped with a modern air defense system protecting Bagram Air Base during U.S. military presence here, emergency exit ways like this one served as a central part of the base. Meanwhile, there have been hundreds of hideouts like this one built by American troops to protect them against possible Taliban rocket attacks. Visiting residential buildings of the U.S. forces in Bagram is also a need. But the bitter fact is that Afghan forces even do not have access to the codes of some doors of the residential buildings in Bagram. So they have no way but to use things like this chair to keep the doors open.
And here is a residential room that was used by American soldiers in the Bagram military air base.
The presence of meal packages, air conditioner systems, refrigerators, microwaves, internet access and TVs that have been left in residential areas by the U.S. forces once again proves that how big difference was and is between a foreign military soldier and an Afghan soldier. There are also many warehouses like this food warehouse in Bagram. Bagram Hospital is the other destination for us. The modern hospital is dark now and we need to use either torches or our camera light to see what is inside. The flame of Washington's longest war in Afghanistan hospitalized thousands of U.S. soldiers in rooms like this one. These beds, medicines, and medical equipment could save the lives of thousands of wounded U.S. troops. But hundreds of them lost their lives here in Bagram Hospital and never returned back to the U.S. due to severe injuries. And now, with rising insecurity in Afghanistan, only time will tell whether or not the Afghan government can make this strategic air base operational due to shortage of financial resources. Syed Amin Alami, Bagram Air Base in Northern Parwan Province.
At least 19 people have been killed in Western Germany after several houses collapsed following heavy rains and severe flooding. Police say dozens of people have also gone missing while many are stranded on rooftops. They say more houses are at the risk of collapse. Two firefighters have so far been killed while trying to help stranded people. Severe flooding has disrupted railroad and river transport, leaving many areas cut off in the region. At least 200,000 households are now left without power. Shipping has also been suspended on the Rhine River. The army has been deployed to help with rescue operations. Evacuation orders have been issued for parts of the region. The German Weather Service has forecast more heavy rains for the next 2 days. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
June 28, 2021, on the occasion of the National Judiciary Week and the martyrdom anniversary of Ayatollah Martyr Beheshti and other personalities. Asserting the rights of the people is an important responsibility for the judiciary branch. The second point is the issue of the involvement of the judiciary in the assertion of public rights, which previously showed itself in the issue of pursuing production and the factories that were shut down. Of course, it showed itself in other areas as well, such as banning the use of certain natural resources and governmental lands and the like. This is a very necessary and good measure. If some people say that this is not within the scope of the responsibilities of the judiciary branch, this is a completely false statement, and it is against what the law says. Involvement in the assertion of public rights is an important responsibility of the judiciary branch. It is one of the duties of public prosecutors. They should be careful and vigilant, so should the whole branch, as this is a very important task. Of course, public rights are not confined to economic matters. Health, education, the environment, and the like are other issues in the domain of public rights.
Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah.
Supporting those who counsel to do good and who advise against evil. One example of public right is the counsel to do good and the advice against evil. Of course, this wajib, religiously obligatory act is not common in our society the way it should be. Those who counsel to do good and advise against evil should not be left alone. Rather, they should be supported. Of course, I know there are some people who kick up a fuss in the name of counsel to do good and advice against evil with some ulterior motives. Very well. Who should distinguish between real and fake counselors to do good and advisors against evil? It is up to the judiciary to distinguish this. You should back up those whom you understand are real counselors to do good and advisors against evil. As I was told, there is a legal gap regarding the issue of pursuing public rights as well. Now, for example, what is the sentence of a person who has violated public rights? What is the punishment? This is not specified in law. Therefore, different judicial systems in different cities and different parts of the country obviously have to behave according to their personal views. One gives a certain ruling and another gives a different one. Laws are needed for this as well. This was another point.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
It all started in November 2017 when Saudi forces detained dozens of royals and business people and imprisoned them inside the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh under the pretext of an anti-corruption drive ordered by the newly appointed Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, also known as MBS. He has gone to great lengths to consolidate power and eliminate potential rivals ever since. On March 6, 2020, Mohammed bin Nayef, Saudi Arabia's former crown prince, was detained on the charge of treason. Saad al-Jabri, a former Saudi spy master and bin Nayef's longtime aide, is the latest high-profile figure caught in the heated rivalry. Jabri alleged in a lawsuit last year that MBS sent a, quote, tiger squad to assassinate him in Canada, where he lives in exile. He also said the crown prince detained his two children to pressure him to go back home. Two lawsuits filed by Saudi state-run companies are accusing Jabri of embezzlement. The firms are part of a network providing cover for clandestine operations with the U.S. Court documents show Jabri intends to make revelations that include matters related to, quote, U.S. national security activities, raising concerns inside Washington and prompting the U.S. to consider a rare judicial intervention.
When it was revealed that the Crown Prince had sent his assassin squads to Canada to assassinate one of his former security aides, people just became more alarmed that another repeat of the Khashoggi drama was unfolding. And it is not a joke, these threats to assassinate opposition figures by some Gulf countries is a very serious business.
Jamal Khashoggi was a Saudi dissident journalist who was killed and dismembered at the kingdom's embassy in Istanbul in October 2018. From Yemen to Istanbul, Saudi Arabia has left a trail of bodies behind. But that's not to say it doesn't target its people within the confines of its borders.
The Saudis have always had a bleak record on human rights. Their record is simply black. They arrest people for expressing their opinion. They kill, they behead and crucify opponents for the smallest of things, for criticizing the regime, for asking to improve their own lives.
As MBS kicked off his campaign of crackdown on dissent, he announced a series of social reforms, including the so-called women's rights reforms, lifting bans on driving and travel restrictions. Amid all the fanfare, however, the kingdom launched a tougher crackdown on women's rights activists raising questions about Riyadh's intentions in announcing the reforms. Just weeks before the Saudi government lifted the ban on women's driving, Lujain Al-Hathloul, an activist who campaigned for women's driving rights, was detained. A prison guard working in a Dahban central prison has given an account of how female prisoners, including Al-Hathloul, were and are being tortured. The guard has said that inmates are subjected to violent treatments, including electric shocks, beatings, whippings, and sexual assaults.
This treatment amounts to crimes against humanity. They are considered crimes of humanity, against humanity, whether it is torture, whether it is arbitrary detention, whether it is extrajudicial killing.
U.S. President Joe Biden vowed earlier this year to press Saudi Arabia over its rights records, but later decided not to penalize the kingdom for assassinating Khashoggi. If the violators of human rights aren't held accountable, doesn't that embolden them to think they can carry on and get away with murder in its most literal sense?
The Mujahideen Khalq group sided with the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein when the Ba'athist regime attacked Iran in 1980. The group claims to have fought for the Iranian people, yet it has the blood of thousands of Iranian civilians on its hands. This year, the annual three-day meeting of the MKO terrorist group is hosted by Albania. The group gathers hired supporters among several former and current American and European officials to deliver paid speeches. This year, several high-profile Western politicians, including Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša, a number of U.S. lawmakers, as well as former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, are among invitees. Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša also delivered a speech at the conference that drew harsh criticism from Iran and promoted the Iranian Foreign Ministry to summon the Slovenian ambassador to Tehran. In a statement on Sunday, the ministry slammed the Slovenian prime minister's move as unacceptable and undiplomatic. Angered by the participation of Iranians in the June presidential election, Pompeo claimed that the vote was a boycott.
The program of sanctions and pressure employed by the Trump administration needs to remain the model for engagement with Iran if we want to ensure the security of the American people and better lives for the Iranian people. In Washington, D.C., there is much consensus, as evidenced by the overwhelming support for the sanctions regime that we put into place.
In response, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said the MKO is a terrorist cult having the blood of Iranian people on its hands. Saeed Khatibzadeh denounced Western politicians, including Pompeo, for selling themselves cheap to the Europe-hosted circus. He also accused the West of shameful hypocrisy driven by an insatiable thirst for money and anti-Iran obsession.
Well, I think it's fairly obvious that the MKO is being supported by the Western countries because it is essentially carrying out imperialist interests. Obviously, the MKO is right there in design in order to overthrow the Iranian government and place some kind of cult activity inside the country. I mean, it's very clear that they're being used as a proxy force to fight the Iranian government.
Iran has always complained that the West's support for a terrorist group such as MKO violates the UN Charter and international norms. The Mujahideen Khalq organization has conducted numerous assassinations and bombings against Iranian statesmen and civilians since the 1979 victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution. Out of the nearly 17,000 Iranians killed in different terrorist attacks over the past four decades, about 12,000 of them have fallen victim to the MKO. MKO's rift with Iran worsened when its leader, Masoud Rajavi, aligned with former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the eight-year Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s. MKO received funding, weapons, ammunition, vehicles, and the use of land in exchange for its support for Saddam. Despite all the crimes committed by the MKO, it is not currently listed by any Western country as a terrorist organization. The European Union and the US that often claim to be anti-terrorism rather removed the MKO from their lists of terror organizations in 2009 and 2012 respectively. Ever since, the West has changed its stance toward the MKO, propagating it not only as an opposition group, but misses no chance to fund the group and lobby in its favor by putting a blind eye to how the MKO spilled the blood of innocent people.
So this is a long-standing policy by the United States, and it shows that the U.S. is not interested in fighting terrorism whatsoever. They're very fond of being able to use terrorists to their own ends, to carry out their own means whenever it's in their interests to do so.
The West's support for the hated MKO group has added to a more feeling of distrust among Iranians toward the Western governments. West's support for a terrorist cult only exposes their double standards when it comes to terrorist organizations. Haiti's president Jovenel Moïse was killed during an attack on his private residence in the capital of Port-au-Prince on early Wednesday. Haiti's first lady was also wounded in the attack and evacuated to a hospital in Miami for treatment. She later accused enemies of sending mercenaries to kill the president and his family to thwart democratic changes in the country. That's why none of the Moïse's guards were injured in the attack. Moreover, Haitian officials have not yet provided a motive for the assassination or explained how the killers got past Moïse's security detail. Haitian police says they have identified 28 people in connection to the fatal shooting, of which two were U.S. citizens. The rest, all Colombian, remain at large. The Colombian Defense Ministry says initial findings suggest that several of the attackers have been retired members of the Colombian military. Colombian police have confirmed that four companies were involved in the assassination of the Haitian president. The companies recruited Colombian nationals who traveled to Haiti through the neighboring Dominican Republic. On the other hand, when pressed on reports that two Haitian Americans were involved with the assassination, the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki declined to comment. This arouses suspicions about possible U.S. involvement. After all, the U.S. has a track record when it comes to these types of operations. In 2020, two U.S. citizens were arrested in Venezuela. The Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, accused Washington of plotting to invade his country, overthrow, and assassinate him. Maduro claimed that the invaders were trained and funded by the U.S. and Colombia. Also, there was the infamous Bay of Pigs operation. 50 years ago, a group of some 1,500 Cuban exiles, trained and financed by the CIA, launched an ill-fated invasion of Cuba from the sea in the Bay of Pigs. The plan was to overthrow Fidel Castro and his revolution. Furthermore, the U.S. track record in Haiti speaks volumes in how the U.S. has treated the country. A simple history check reveals the deep U.S. involvement in this tiny island nation. In 1914, the U.S. sent Marines into Haiti. It gained complete control over Haitian finances and the right to intervene in Haiti whenever the U.S. government deemed necessary at the time. The U.S. government also forced the election of a new pro-American president by the Haitian legislature in August 1915. The selection of a president that did not represent the choice of the Haitian populace increased unrest in Haiti. Meanwhile, Haiti has been struggling with a wave of extreme violence, a growing humanitarian crisis, and a worsening coronavirus pandemic, and now the assassination of Moïse has thrown the country into deeper turmoil as his death leaves a power vacuum.
However, we do know for sure the United States that this solves a lot of problems for the United States regarding its interest in Haiti and their support for Jovenel Moïse and that administration. It was an untenable situation. They had already been supporting him through a very suspect abolishing of the Constitution. He extended his term. Now he was ruling by decree, and they were about to force on the Haitian people another election and a new constitution under very, you know, circumstances in which the Haitian people didn't want. Clearly, the masses of Haitian people were in the street.
A Haitian President Jovenel Moïse's death has led to confusion about who is the legitimate person to lead the country of 11 million people. Claude Joseph, who had resigned as prime minister, took charge of the government and named himself acting president in the hours after the assassination. Ariel Henry, whom Moïse had named prime minister but had not yet taken office, also claims he should be in charge. Furthermore, Joseph Lambert, who leads what remains of the Haitian Senate, joined two others seeking to rule the nation, announced that he was voted provisional president by his fellow senators Friday evening. With tensions high in the capital, crowds of people took to the streets Thursday night, burning cars and demanding justice. Meanwhile, the COVID-19 pandemic has been worsening in Haiti. According to the United Nations Children's Agency, Haiti was the only country in the Western Hemisphere to not have received a single dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. At the same time, according to the World Bank, the country is facing a dire economic situation. Its economy had shrunk further 3.8% in 2020, with about 60% of the population now living in poverty. Furthermore, according to UNICEF, more than 1.5 million children are currently in urgent need of humanitarian assistance in Haiti.
The United States is directly responsible for the situation, decidedly so. It's intentional to keep Haiti underdeveloped, to keep control of its resources and its labor and its markets under the control of foreign corporations.
With Haiti having a track record of interference from Western governments like the U.S. and France, it remains to be seen whether the country will be able to preserve any peace and stability as it goes through this transformation. Moïse's murder has prompted the government to call for U.S. and UN assistance. At this point, the U.S. has said it will only take necessary action to defend Americans and critical infrastructure.
Gun violence is killing more people in the U.S. state of New York than the COVID-19 pandemic. That's according to New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. He announced on Thursday that he has declared gun violence in New York a disaster emergency, making extra funding and resources available to combat shootings statewide. The first of its kind executive order came at a time when New York City and the country as a whole are struggling to curtail the spike in gun violence. Speaking during an event at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, Cuomo said his plan includes short-term and long-term measures that treat gun violence as a public health crisis. Cuomo said nearly $139 million will be invested in prevention and employment programs to help youth and keep at-risk young people off the streets.
Fact, gun violence discriminates. The way COVID discriminated, gun violence discriminates. When you look among the victims of gun violence nationally, 59% non-white. New York State, 68% non-white. New York City, 77% non-white. Think about that, 77%.
Well, these poor Black and Latino neighborhoods and people are likely to be victims because crime is rampant in these communities. But why is crime rampant in these communities? Well, as we see and we know, poverty exacerbates not only just gun violence, but all sorts of violence, petty theft, nonviolent crimes, drugs, gang violence. And these poor Black and Latino neighborhoods have been neglected by the government, by New York State, as well as their neighborhoods have been sold out. Gentrification throughout New York City is specifically targeting neighborhoods in Brooklyn, Queens, and the Bronx.
Cuomo also announced he was going to sign legislation that allows for civil lawsuits against gun manufacturers, distributors, and dealers for how they market and sell firearms. The governor added that over the 4th of July weekend, at least 51 people fell victim to gun violence across the U.S. state alone. U.S. President Joe Biden announced last month his plan to fight the rising gun crimes across the country.
Today, the department is announcing, as I just did, a major crackdown on stem the flow of guns used to commit violent crimes. It's zero tolerance for gun dealers who willfully violate key existing laws and regulations. And I repeat, zero tolerance.
His plan includes allocating more funds to law enforcement agencies to improve their ability to track and disrupt gun trafficking. He's set to meet with the country's law enforcement, local elected officials, and advocates to discuss the plan on Monday. The White House says the $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief package provides funding not only to the police, but also to programs such as youth employment, which can help reduce crime rates. The Democrats and Republicans are now pointing fingers at each other over soaring gun violence, with the GOPs criticizing Biden's performance in fighting crimes and Democrats blaming their political rivals for blocking their proposals on gun control.
The American obsession with guns at its root is because our founding fathers and the right have just made it part of the American identity, make it seem as if to be American is to own a gun, when being American is so much more than that. It's about working hard and defending your neighbor and, you know, wanting better for yourselves.
An FBI report in March pointed to a 25% increase in the number of homicide cases in 2020 compared to a year before. Figures suggest the rising trend has continued into 2021, fueling concerns that the U.S. could witness one of its highest numbers of homicides it has ever recorded this year.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked as
the holy prophet of Islam is the example
of عمل انسان بعد از
self purification is the most significant factor.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
امامت is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by famous Iranian Shiite orator and lecturer, Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
علامه طباطبایی 40 سال زندگی متأهلانه داشت.
علامه محمد حسین طباطبایی, the author of the famous exegesis of the Holy Quran Al-Mizan, lived with his wife for 40 years until she passed away. When علامه طباطبایی heard the news of his wife's death, he fainted, and from that time on he had the heart disease for the rest of his life. He cried very much for his loss. He was told by his friends and family, "You are a scholar, a faqih, a mufassir or exegete of the Holy Quran. Why do you act in such a manner? Death is for everyone, including your wife." Allama Tabatabai answered, "My intolerance and shed of tears upon my wife's death is not because of my complaint towards Allah. It is for her loyalty and kindness towards me. For 40 years, she did not break my heart even for a moment. My shedding tears is for losing the efforts that she made in supporting me to do my researches and studies. My name is on Al-Mizan exegesis of the Holy Quran, but in fact, this tafsir was written by two people, me and my wife, who supported me during all these years." Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com, Call of Islam page, We leave you in Allah's care. Fi aman Allah.
Yugoslavia from a historical standpoint.
Part 1.
Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. Milosevic reigned over what was left of Yugoslavia as it fell apart in the 1990s, surviving crippling UN sanctions, wars in Slovenia, Croatia, and Bosnia, violent Albanian separatism in Kosovo, NATO airstrikes against his country, an ICTY war crimes indictment, and 40 years of marriage with a control freak wife, Milosevic was definitely a force to be reckoned with. Brutal towards his opponents at home and abroad, this banker, who at one time worked in New York City as a representative of the Yugoslav bank Belbanka, where he even met American banker David Rockefeller, seemed to not really care about the economic trends that were spreading in the region. Strobe Talbot, Deputy Secretary of State under U.S. President Bill Clinton and the lead U.S. negotiator during the Kosovo War, said that as nations throughout the region sought to reform their economies, mitigate ethnic tensions, and broaden civil society, Belgrade seemed to delight in continually moving in the opposite direction. It was Yugoslavia's resistance to the broader trends of political and economic reform, not the plight of the Kosovar Albanians, that best explains NATO's war.
As long as Milosevic remains in control, the international community will have little influence over what happens in Belgrade.
Since Milosevic didn't want to give up or share his control over the economy with anyone else, he needed to go. And he needed to go fast. Just like this guy, and 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 many others. But it was 2000, elections in Yugoslavia were just around the corner, and it was Milosevic's turn to go. This is me, protesting against Milosevic in my hometown of Subotica, Yugoslavia in 2000. I was a kid, and all I wanted was for my country to be more open, more accepted in the world community. And I wasn't alone. Since the early 1990s, there were many mass demonstrations against Milosevic, and they were led by opposition leaders such as Vuk Drašković and Zoran Đinđić. Under Milosevic, crime and corruption was around every corner, and many of his policies were extremely damaging for the people. Millions in Yugoslavia thought that if we were friendly towards the West, we'd quickly live just like they do. But to overthrow someone like Milosevic, you needed a serious team to get the job done.
Hello, I'm Marović, Ivan Marović. In 2000, my friends and I brought down Slobodan Milošević.
Make repression work for you. Make craziness the norm. 10,000 people in the street is news. 10 people in the street is obviously not news. But 10 people in the street doing something crazy, now that's news.
This guy made a revolution happen? You've got to be kidding me. There had to have been more to it. And there was. During the Cold War, the U.S. government loved to interfere in the domestic affairs of other countries. Among others, this was the task of the National Endowment